Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. With 1 month to go before California's March primary, we find out what's new in the Fresno mayoral race, and we meet some of the lesser-known candidates. Plus, California's complex pesticide laws are hard to understand. But what if you don't read English? A team of educators has created a series of training videos in Hmong. But first, let's turn to sports and the national pastime. Back in 1927, baseball legends Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig came to Fresno to play exhibition matches, sometimes playing with all Japanese-American teams. One of those players was an immigrant from Japan who has been nominated for the Baseball Hall of Fame. FM89's Laura Satsui tells us how he used the game as a way to break barriers, even while interred.
His name was Kenichi Zenimura. Here's actor Noriyuki Pat Morita narrating a 1999 documentary about him.
Amongst all the legends was always the image of Kenichi Zenimura. His peers called him player, coach, captain, manager. He'll always be remembered as Zenny, Dean of the Diamond.
The film is called Diamonds in the Rough. Here's producer Kariyo Nakagawa.
He always was ahead of everyone else in strategy. Kenichi Zenimura could have played, I feel, Major League Baseball.
An immigrant from Japan, Kenichi Zenimura coached and played baseball in Fresno before World War II. He built two fields and even helped bring Babe Ruth to play in Japan. Bill Staples Jr., a baseball historian, wrote Zenimura's biography. He considers Zenimura a civil rights pioneer.
He would go into towns where they had signs that said Japanese not welcome, and he'd go in and he'd schedule games, and eventually they were welcome.
Small rural towns in the valley, like Livingston. His nomination into the Baseball Hall of Fame is due to these efforts. He was an ambassador for the sport, both in the San Joaquin Valley and in Japan. But this was before the U.S. entered World War II.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave those remarks the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Months later, West Coast Japanese Americans were forced inland. At 42 years old, Kenichi Zenimura had to move his family to a camp in the Arizona desert. There, they were fenced in with barbed wire, guard towers, and only allowed a suitcase each. But even then, he used baseball to connect with the outside world. Staples says he had access to the Phoenix newspaper and would take out ads inviting teams to come play at the camp. In exchange, Zenimura offered them a portion of the ticket sales, and thousands of camp residents came out to watch the games.
And he would read about all these great teams on the outside, and so he invited them in to play.
How did he do this in a place so barren and a place he wasn't allowed to leave? With what little they had, the family built a baseball field.
They utilized flour to line the base paths and the foul lines.
That's Zenimura's great-grandson, Brandon Zenimura. On this day, he's just visited the camp for the first time and is sitting outside the nearby Chandler Museum.
Grandpa planted and irrigated. They were castor bean plants, so they grew super tall, so we planted them as the outfield wall. The bases were bags that were filled with rice.
They used old mattress pads to pad the backstop.
I mean, the dugouts were real dugouts. The bleachers were from the lumber that they would steal from the government. It truly was a field of dreams.
Kenichi's son, Howard Kenso, also Brandon's grandpa, ended up playing in college after being released from the camp.
My grandfather always talked about how baseball, in a way, saved them. He would have been a juvenile delinquent if he didn't have baseball because it gave him something to do.
He even played professionally in Japan, but Kenichi himself never did. like many Japanese Americans, Kenichi struggled to find a job after the camps. He managed day laborers until he died in 1968. Inside the Gila River Indian community, there's a monument honoring Japanese Americans who fought in World War II. It's one of the few indications that a camp ever existed there. The baseball field is gone, replaced by an olive orchard, but the landscape is much the same. Brandon says when he stepped out of the car to see the monument, he was reminded of how much his grandfather hated rocks.
Like, he always commented about how many stinking rocks there were and how many stinking rocks he had to pick up every single day, sack full of rocks.
That desert, Brandon says, isn't the easiest place to build a field, and yet they did, and got away with it.
Because it was on the other side of the barbed wire, so what? Why were they not stopped?
Maybe because baseball is the American pastime. Or because the sport lifted everyone's spirits, including the guards. Or maybe the power of the sport can't be explained.
I don't know. There's something about the grass, something about dirt, and a ball, and leather, and a bat, a stick. I don't know. There's something about it that's magical.
Brandon's great-grandfather, Kenichi, died in 1968. His grandfather, Howard Kenzo, died in 2018. With them gone, Brandon considers himself someone to pass on these memories for his family.
As memory keepers, I think it's so important to hold on to these stories.
He says he's keeping these memories for his own daughter, a toddler, with the hopes that she passes them on as well. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. We've just heard reporter Laura Satsui's story about baseball in the Japanese-American internment camp in Gila River, Arizona. Laura traveled to the camp for that story. And this month is the 78th anniversary of the signing of Executive Order 9066, which is the order that sent Japanese-Americans to the camps in the first place. We have Laura in the studio to talk more about the local connection between Gila River and the San Joaquin Valley. So to start, Laura, tell us about the trip. What was the impetus to go?
A lot of these internment camps have pilgrimages, and there are 10 camps in total. You know, a number of people went to different camps. Some of the camps have monuments or museums. Gila River is different because Gila River is land governed by the Gila River Indian community, and so it's not open to the public. You have to get a permit. You have to be someone either who is interned or who is a descendant of someone interned. And yet the Arizona Japanese American Citizens League organizes twice a year. They go out there, and there is a monument there to Japanese Americans who fought in World War II. And so the JACL goes out, cleans it up, you know, does any painting if there's graffiti, and they allow just other members of the public to go as part of that cleanup. And so I heard about it through Nikiko Masumoto, a local peach farmer who has relatives who were interned at Gila River. So she had been before because she was allowed. And so she asked me to go along.
And your grandparents were interned as well, right?
Yeah. So that made this kind of a really interesting personal story. So my grandparents, Tak and Satoko Satsui, they were interned in their early teen years. They're Japanese Americans, obviously, but they were born here in the U.S., and it was just because their parents and grandparents were born in Japan. But they weren't interned at Gila River. They were sent to Poston, which is another camp sort of in the Arizona desert, and Jerome, Arkansas.
So you get into this a bit in the story, but what's at Gila River now? What's there?
Yeah, as we're driving through, there's not a lot. It's basically just dirt and desert. But as you're driving through, there's also a lot of agriculture, lots of orchards. I mentioned in the story that the baseball field Kenichi Zenimura created is now an olive orchard. And I want to play a little clip of the people I was in the car with, including Nikiko Masumoto. She described it this way.
We're seeing flat desert landscape with a few buttes. Some of the native plants look like they've come back. And you actually can see occasionally cement little foundations. That those are from camp.
And then as we drove up to the monument itself, it's kind of on this ridge. I was also in the car with Sean Mura. He's an artist and he does marketing in Los Angeles. And here's kind of how he described what the monument looks like as you come up to it.
At the top of the hill, there is a huge white semicircle sort of structure, an amphitheater of sorts, kind of towering above and overlooking this all the crops and all the dry land. And it's pretty striking. It's kind of the only thing that feels out of place so far.
And he says feels out of place, I want to point out, because like I said, there's like nothing there. You're almost wondering, like, were people interned here? What used to exist? It's just brush and dirt and not much else.
So can you explain who was sent to which relocation camp? Because there were a number of them.
So about 120,000 Japanese Americans were sent to these camps. Some were immigrants from Japan. Many were citizens born here. 13,000 ended up in Gila River, and it seems like people in East Fresno County, maybe from the Sanger area, those were people sent to Gila River, so that included Nikiko's grandparents. But then some Fresno Japanese Americans were sent to Jerome, Arkansas, much further away, and then south of, I think, the 180, I had a relative in Hanford who was sent to Poston, Arizona. And so it seems that somehow the state was divided up into various ways, and depending on what part of, you know, the state that you lived in or what part of the valley you lived in, even if you're a Japanese American, you were sent to a different camp. And so that's part of why so many of us went to Gila River, is because, you know, Nikiko had relatives, Sean had relatives. So many of them were like young kids or teenagers, or even people were born in the camps. So those are the kinds of people that were there.
What did it feel like to be there?
Nikiko said this really funny thing, that it was exciting to just, and bittersweet, because we were seeing the place that her ancestors had been, and then just really able to experience to some extent what they experienced. I mean, seeing that barren landscape, I can only imagine, you know, leaving your furnished home and your belongings and driving 10 hours into the middle of nowhere, this desert, and then being told, okay, you live here now. It's one of those things where I think to myself, like, I could never truly imagine what that feels like, because even on sort of our road trip, you know, we had all these luxuries and we knew we were coming home. And so, and they went to these camps not knowing when or if they would come home. And, you know, some people did die there, like older relatives and things like that. I didn't have family in Gila River, but it instilled in me this feeling of like, oh, I really need to see where my grandparents were now, because I know those landscapes are a little different. It just gave me so much perspective and made me think about, like, what our families went through, what the government basically put some of them through, and made me think, like, okay, that's really interesting. And, you know, I'm still processing. Months later, I'm still processing.
Absolutely. I can only imagine. Well, thank you so much for sharing the story of your experience and for the amazing reporting you did while you were there.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
This week in Fresno, the mayoral race heated up as three members of the city council criticized candidate Jerry Dyer's strategy to address homelessness, and the Fresno Bee gave its endorsement to Dyer's rival, Andrew Jans. To discuss the race, I sat down with GV Wire news director Bill McEwen, West Hills College political science professor Nick Guerra, and Fresno Bee columnist Marek Warzowski. Marek, you wrote a column in the Bee about Jerry Dyer's decision to back out of the February 13th candidate forum. That event is co-hosted by Faith in the Valley, Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, and the Fresno Building Healthy Communities. Tell us about the explanation you got from the Dyer campaign.
Well, the forum was originally scheduled for last week. It was on previous Thursday. And when I texted Jerry for an explanation for why he isn't going to go, he emailed me something back. It was a couple paragraph explanation. First of all, he told me about a conflict for that evening with another forum by a veterans organization that he had committed to. So there was that in his mind. And also, he expressed a little concern. He cited numerous sources to him in the campaign. He was concerned if the forum could be held in an objective and impartial manner. And there was a little bit of concern with perhaps some of the audience members or some of the attendees would not act in a way that, you know, standard conduct, maybe could get a little unruly. There was he did express a little concern for perhaps for his safety. That was the two reasons that he gave me, and I printed both those reasons, you know, in my column. So, and you know, with the site, you know, without an explanation, because that's, you know, that's what he told me.
So, Bill, you moderated a forum for GV Wire that had both Jantz and Dyer. I mean, what are you hearing? What do you think are the reasons behind Dyer's decision?
So I would give credence to both of those things that were cited to Marek, but I think there's also political consideration as well, and very unlikely that Jerry Dyer would win over very many people in the audience there. And so for him, I think that it's a matter of time, invested time, and he sees other audiences where he's more likely to win votes.
Nick, do you agree?
Yeah, but I also want to say that there's no reason to at this point as well, too, because I think, and I just saw Jerry 2 weeks ago. I talked to him as well about the race, and he's focused on that March election, and I think he's trying to wrap it up at, you know, the 51 or 50% whatever vote that he needs exactly to get this done with. Now, if he doesn't obviously hit that threshold, then yes, there are going to be debates. There's going to be more frequent debates, just like the last one between Perea and Lee Brand. I don't know. I've lost count on how many debates they had in the final month. So I think Jerry's focused on the March race, and he wants to wrap it up if he can get it done with, because if not, he's going into a very tough battle with Jantz because of the presidential election at that point.
Mark, what do you think? Can he wrap it up?
I was thinking that there was a good chance that he could wrap it up, but there was a certain poll and a certain news website named GV Wire that came out a couple of weeks ago that showed Jantz actually slightly ahead. So that maybe put a little pause into my thinking.
But I question, I mean, and no offense to GV Wire, I mean, I'm a Granville homeowner as well, and I know Darius as well. And my personal thoughts on that one is it's always going to be tougher for Democrats when it comes to the special elections or the midterm elections and all that stuff, because the volume is not there. But now, again, the trends have changed recently, nationally as well. But I see Jantz being a bigger threat in the November election than a March election.
McEwen, you know,
I have things to say on this. First okay. of all, it was a plus or minus 4% poll. A lot of thought went into the turnout model. It was very specific for this primary. I would point out that the gold standard of national polls is the NBC Wall Street Journal poll. It's rated A by everyone that goes into polling, and there's plus or minus 4.7%. This was a plus or minus 4% poll, unheard of to be done in this area, done by very professional people. So I would say people that want to dismiss this poll, do so at your peril.
So you think that...
I think there's a lot of denial around here about what's going on. And, you know, I don't want to dominate the conversation, but I've been covering mayoral races in Fresno for 40 years. And this is the most partisan race I've ever seen. And I don't think that the names matter much. They matter more in Jerry Dyer's case because he's the more established name and he can campaign full time. Jantz is at a huge disadvantage. He just had a baby. He has to work. He doesn't get a lot of time off. But in our poll, Jantz pulled 83% support from Democrats. Dyer, he always talks about he's winning over the other side. His support was 93% Republican. This is a highly partisan race. I think it reflects the Trump effect.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talked to Jantz a couple weeks ago. He was very clear. He understands it's all about turnout for him. Nick, nobody has a crystal ball, but what's your prediction?
I'm still predicting Dyer. And again, polls, you know, we can go back to the 2016 presidential election. I mean, every poll in the nation had Hillary Clinton winning it, except I think two. I mean, I think Los Angeles Times was one and somebody else too. So
That's not true. All those polls had both candidates within the margin of error. This is a kind of dialogue that's been pushed forever, and it's simply not true. That was a very close race going in, and if you paid close attention to the polls, both candidates were in the margin of error. In fact, on the Sunday before the election, I wrote the editorial for the Fresno Bee, and the lead was, don't be surprised if Donald Trump wins.
Well,
the other thing is the new voting system, right?
Exactly.
That throws another a wrench into the equation, and we're not exactly sure how the voters around here are going to respond to that. You know, in my mind, it's like, well, it's more confusing to vote now because people are changing a long-time habit. But then if you look at other counties that have enacted this voting system, they've shown increases. Madera County showed a 16% increase. So perhaps that'll happen in Fresno County also. And we all know that the more people that vote, the better it is, you know, generally for the Democratic candidate, even though this is officially a nonpartisan race.
And there are also other things happening, which is all the money that Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg are spending in the Valley, and it's all geared towards Super Tuesday. And they have their people on the ground. It's way more than volunteers. It's professional staff, and they're out there registering people, and more of them are going to be Democrat than Republican, and they're going to do ballot harvesting. There's going to be a huge effort by Bloomberg to get people to the polls if they haven't filled out their form. So this goes way beyond being a local race.
And Nick, why don't you tell us what ballot harvesting is?
Well, ballot harvesting, I mean, is basically people coming around and collecting your ballots on the promise that, hey, we'll take your ballots for you and we'll go drop it off at the precinct or the polling stations and whatnot for you. It's people coming to you also to say, hey, did you fill out your ballot yet? Why don't you fill it out real quick and I'll take it and go take to the station for you. I mean, it's like the customer service of balloting, and it's legal in California, but then there's other states that it's not legal. And, I mean, people have actually, you know, faced punishment of the law for doing that in North Carolina. I don't even think that's an equal standard, and I think the courts are going to decide, for federal side at least, whether ballot harvesting is legal or not. It's a huge, huge, huge shift in politics and the voting process. And coming back to the Dyer situation, if Dyer's going to win, he has to wrap it up in March, because coming into November, when you'll see that Bloomberg and all that effect that you're talking about with Tom Steyer in play, that I don't know what's going to happen in November. If Dyer's going to wrap it, it's going to wrap it in March, or you're right, I think the polls at that point will have a bigger sway towards Jans, and I'm still standing with that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking about the Fresno mayoral race. Merrick, there was a lot of news this week regarding the race. Jans received a $20,000 donation from Miguel Arias. He got an endorsement from the Fresno Bee. And really, homelessness took center stage as a issue that perhaps Jans believes Dyer is vulnerable. Do you think that's a winning strategy?
I mean, I think it is a winning strategy, although I didn't, you know, I listened. I wasn't in attendance for each editorial board meeting that we had with Jans and Dyer, but I watched the video of it. And I mean, yes, there are differences in their homeless policies, but they're not strikingly different. I think that they both, are kind of espousing the same philosophy and some of the same views. Same with the forum that Bill hosted. I didn't think that their answers were decidedly different. I don't know if either side would agree with me, but when I hear it, that's what I hear to my eyes. I'm hearing subtle differences, but not major policy differences.
Bill.
So, Andrew Jans is a blue dog Democrat. When he's in front of a crowd, he plays a progressive. I mean, I covered him in the congressional race. I've gotten to know him quite well. He is a conservative Democrat. A lot of his support comes from the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So he has to always kind of balance that. Jerry Dyer, we know where he stands. In some regards, I would say that Jerry's a lot more progressive than the way his critics portray him. Jerry Dyer is a formidable candidate in this race. What's interesting, what interests me about this race is, again, it's a mechanical thing, and that's the fact that Jerry's out there campaigning all the time, extremely busy, shaking hands, making lots of appearances, even though he's not going to that forum. And Jans is relying on surrogates. So you think about it. It's an independent expenditure group that's running the social media ads that go very hard after Dyer, particularly about his past. That group's largely funded by the Arambula family. And then what we had yesterday, when I saw it, I said, hey, the mayor's race has finally started. Because you had Miguel Arias out there, and, I mean, he had been neutral. He's not neutral anymore. And he was really going after Jerry Dyer and saying very incendiary things. And Dyer responded in kind. So, again, I can't think of a Fresno mayor's race where one of the major candidates has been represented nearly all the time by surrogates. And that's what's happening with Jans.
So we just have a few more minutes before we wrap up, but I want to switch gears and talk about the Fresno City Council race. Merrick, you wrote a column about the District 4.
It's such an interesting race, right? Because it's, you know, I've sat down with, you know, both Tyler Maxwell and Nathan Alonzo. I found them to be very intelligent, very dedicated, very motivated, and the exact type of people that we want, you know, young people engaged in politics and trying to make a difference. And here are these two young men that I think are both coming at it for really good reasons and genuine reasons. And yet, if you look at their bases of support, it couldn't be more disparate. And it's, you know, it's the traditional old Fresno political power brokers who have kind of ruled this town for a long time on one side, and the progressives on the other side, who have been gaining numbers and, you know, voter registration advantages. And it's just a very, it's just a very fascinating race. It'll be very interesting to see, you know, what happens. You know, we know 2 years ago, the establishment candidates, they were both soundly defeated despite pretty large fundraising, you know, advantages.
And depending on who wins, that could really shape the
idea. It certainly could, and coupled with who will be the next mayor.
Right. So we could potentially see a scenario in which the kind of gridlock that's happening in Washington is happening in Fresno. We have a very progressive-leaning city council, but a conservative mayor. Nick, do you think that's a fair assessment?
100%. Jerry Dyer's future is attached to Nathan Alonzo, and vice versa, with Jan's future being attached to Maxwell. Both young candidates, and, you know, it's that old school, new school type blood. They are really similar in a lot of their views, though, that they're both addressing the homeless issue. And I live in their district, actually, so I've seen both of them on the streets. I know Nathan Alonzo very well. He does sometimes kind of, I disagree sometimes with his strategy of like, oh yeah, I represent big money and all that stuff. And he says it openly. And I don't know if that's a good thing or not in today's politics. Whereas Tyler is trying to be the more grassroots candidate and saying, hey, I'm not taking corporate money. I'm going for the average Joe here. So very interesting campaign strategies in terms of their money.
And Bill, I'd like to close with your thoughts on that race.
So I'd be very careful with this. I think that Nathan, when you analyze his positions, he's not a traditional Republican. He's more towards the center. And Tyler Maxwell, yes, he's a progressive. Yes, he works for Nelson Esparza. But you got to remember, they represent their district. And so to say they're going to vote one way or another all the time, it's just not going to happen. That doesn't happen at the city council level. They're going to try and do what's best for their district. And the other thing I would point out is that, so you have Mike Carbasi, he's a conservative Democrat. Luis Chavez, I mean, people say he's part of this progressive wing. Are you kidding me? He's very conservative. So it'll be a very interesting split, and it will depend on the issue.
Well, there's lots of change happening for the city of Fresno. I really appreciate you all taking the time to break it down for us. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
While Dyer and Jans are the clear frontrunners in the race to become mayor of Fresno, they are among a field of seven candidates vying for the job.
This week, I spoke with three of the lesser-known candidates about the experience of running as an outsider and their vision for Fresno.
I don't need your money. I've made enough money to be a Republican, and I've had money where I thought I was a Democrat. But I don't like blue or red. I don't like blue or red dividing our city.
That was Richard Renteria, a resident of the Tower District whose ambition to run the city of Fresno goes back to 2012 when he ran as a write-in candidate. In 2016, he threw his hat in the ring once again.
Didn't get what I was looking for in that, and I knew I wasn't going to win because the city likes to vote for the name.
This time around, Renteria cites fiscal mismanagement and a lack of transparency as the top issues facing the city. When it comes to leadership, he says it's time for something new.
We've been stagnant for the last two mayor terms. Nothing has changed. Homeless hasn't changed. Housing hasn't changed. Employment hasn't changed.
Change was a common theme among the candidates, including Nicholas Wildstar, who was running with the endorsement of the Libertarian Party. He said that many of the voters he encounters are disillusioned with both former police chief Jerry Dyer and Andrew Jantz, who works as a district attorney.
Because they both represent law enforcement, which people, a lot of people see as being a main problem here in the city.
Wildstar's vision for Fresno includes building more parks, establishing a community bank, and an electric utility.
It's paid for by taxpayers, therefore, once it's bought and paid for, we'll have free electricity.
But among all the issues facing the city, Wildstar said the most pressing is homelessness, and he provided a high-tech solution to solve it.
One thing I am offering to do is build 3D-printed homes. this technology does exist. They're homes that can be built in less than 24 hours. They're one-bedroom, one-bathroom, full homes.
Brian Jefferson also pointed to homelessness as a critical issue facing the city. It's a topic that's personal for the candidate, who self-identified as housing insecure.
Not only do I want to see myself change my own situation in that area, but I also, in the same instance, want to see me create a new outlet that changes it for most of us homeless individuals right now today.
All of the candidates acknowledge the uphill battle they face in their campaign to run California's fifth largest city. But Jefferson believes his outsider status could work to his advantage.
This is a classic case of David and Goliath, you know. If the people aren't awaiting this moment and anxious and eagerly prepared to see the outcome in this battle, I mean, that what else could I say?
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Pesticide regulations can be tough to understand, especially among communities that don't speak English. But recently, with the help of local ag advisors and Fresno State production students, the state put together a series of pesticide videos in Hmong. To learn more, FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with Michael Yang of the UC Cooperative Extension, Fresno State student Molly Lee, and UC Merced graduate student Chia Tao.
Okay, so Michael, you're a community education specialist with the UC Cooperative Extension. You helped coordinate this video project with the Department of Pesticide Regulation. What are these videos all about?
Pesticide safety. We have a large small farm, especially Hmong farmer, speaking a different language, so the video will help with that.
And so it's like a set of, I think, 8 or 9 videos, correct? Like, what kinds of topics are covered in them?
Yes. You know, safety, you know, storing, you know, applying, and personal protective equipment, and all those are very important when you use pesticides.
So why was this project necessary? Why were these videos needed, especially in the Hmong language?
Well, you know, we'll probably know that Fresno County is the number one ag county in the nation. And here's, we have a lot of Hmong people, Hmong farmers settled in this area. They mainly farming. And so a lot of them, you know, need to get the help. Say, you're using a lot of chemical and agriculture. So there's a need. So it's very important to have that.
Yeah, I mean, and is there, were the Hmong farmers that you work with through the UC Cooperative Extension, you know, were they feeling like they really lacked information about pesticides? I mean, was there a drive for this within the community?
I say, you know, what the University of California were the first to help on this topic, this issue. And so, yes, it's important. This is the first, I would say the first one in this area.
The first one, the first time we've had videos like this in this area, you mean?
We had one in the 90s, which I had a you know, booklet here, but that's pretty old, and a lot of information update and the regulation change, so we have to update all those safety.
Yeah, the 1990 was 30 years ago. I can imagine California regulations have changed a ton since then.
Yeah, we're in the most, you know, restricted state. Just everything, you know, we have to follow the laws. And if there's regulations, we all have to follow.
Well, so Chia, let's turn to you. You're a PhD student at UC Merced. You've received a fellowship to study the environmental factors that lead to various health outcomes among Hmong farmers. Mm-hmm. Why is this research important?
It's important because not that there's no research looking to this community, so there's a lack of research to really understand their health needs and in general. But, you know, Hmong farmer is very unique in terms of their practices and the type of crops that they grow here in the Central Valley. So my research is I'm hoping to really better understand the Hmong farming practices in terms of health perspective. I'm coming from a public health background, and so I'm really bringing into, you know, what are some of the prevention measures that we could really take into considerations? What are some of the health factors that are can contribute to poor health outcome as part of this community farms? And so I'm really bringing that into my research when I'm looking into the farmers. The Hmong farmers in the Central Valley is also unique. As Michael say, there are first generation farmers here in this country. And so that means that they have a skill set that they could farm, but also they're in a country where there's so much law and regulations, and this is the first time that many of them are exposed to the use of pesticide. So how are our communities integrating and in adapting these practices is also important to understand. And more importantly, our community or majority of the Hmong farmers are also tend to be older, who have limited to no education. So that also bring another issue to the table of why having educational piece is so instrumental in terms of helping the community.
And so what are the major health factors that you think that you'll be investigating, and are pesticides one of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in the future, my long-term goal is to really map out what are some of the health trajectory for Hmong farmers as they continue to farm. What are some of the health indications or implications that can be a result of farming? My goal is really to focus on how can I prevent my community from so that they can continue to be successful Hmong farmers, but at the same time help be in good health and well-being. Following the larger research baseline, using pesticide was shown to cause cancers and other health implications among larger scale farmers and farm workers. And so I expecting that the community would have, due to the practice of farming here in this country, will also be likely to be exposed to pesticides and therefore at the same risk of developing cancers to like all of the other health concerns as the larger farmer community.
Okay, very interesting. And then, Molly, I wanted to turn to you. You're an alumni of Fresno State, mm-hmm. and you were on the production side of this video project along with Michael here. You yourself are also Hmong, and you have family members that are farmers. How did it feel to be a part of this project?
Before I actually got to be a part of the project, I didn't really know a lot about agriculture because distant relatives are farmers, but me and my immediate family, we are not farmers. And so to be put on the project, I wasn't sure at first what I was getting myself into. And so as I went along with the project and started editing and looking at all the footage, I started understanding a little bit more about like the regulations of the pesticides and also seeing how important it is to get the information out there.
And so, you know, what do you, when you talk about this project with family, with friends who are maybe are closer to the agricultural community, you know, what do they have to say about it?
A lot of them are very proud about it, and they're also very glad that I was taking part in this video to kind of help farmers how to understand the regulations better. And so I've talked with a few of my friends, and they're very proud of it. They tell me that, oh, I'm so glad you are my savior, and also just sharing it all on social media. And so it makes me very, very glad to be a part of the project, too.
Yeah, that must be a nice feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so we have these videos taken care of. You know, what are some of the other kind of pressing needs maybe next up, you know, for you, Michael and Shia, that you think need to be addressed within the Hmong farming community?
You know, when you farm, water is very important. So everybody needs water. And a lot of the small farm, like the Hmong farmer, even though they farm a small acre, they still need the water. But the Sigma and... You know, here we have...
Sigma the Sustainable Groundwater Management
right.
Act.
Right, and we're working on that too. And also, you know, with the GSA, the Groundwater Sustainable Agency, we have 7 agencies in this, in our area. And so, you know, all of those are also important for a Hmong farmer community.
So water access in particular, you think
yes.
is one of the next things to think
yes.
about? Because that's also especially an issue for a lot of Hmong farmers are leasing their land, right? So
yes.
I imagine that's a big issue for them as opposed to maybe landowners as well.
Right.
And then Shia, what do you think?
Yes, I agree with the farmer. As we talk to the farmers, what really important to them is water at, you know, one of the factors that could help them so that they could continue to grow. And with all of these laws and policy coming to the Central Valley, we do have farmers who are afraid of the policy because they weren't sure how it's going to impact their practices in the future. And so there need to be an agency like Michael who really walk the farmer through the process of these policy, right? Because again, if you look into 100 pages of this policy, and if, you know, giving someone who's very literate or could read, you there's so much jargon that we still don't understand. And so really put those contexts into simple terms that the Hmong farmers could really understand how these law will impact them. It's important. The Hmong farmer is just very unique in terms of that their practices are different. So that means, you know, some of these policies are very either adversely impacting their practices or, you know, their needs are many times are not really being highlighted in the larger general Sigma agenda, for example. And so just small things that they're concerned about. And I think they're just going to be so much more needs with the community. My goal is to really... I hope that I could inspire them to continue to farm because talking to the Hmong farmers, farming, it's really an identity piece for them. And so I really want them to continue on that traditions because this is a practice that was taught to them from generations to generations. And I really don't want for them to be discouraged because of all of these policies and regulations. And I really want them to continue to farm and contribute back to the communities and to know that they're being valued, that their skill sets are being valued here in the Central Valley and that people cares that, you know, we have the community who care and that they farm and they give back to, you know, the produce that they grow here really could be a great asset to the community here. And I really want them to know that.
Yeah. And it's especially crops like you want fresh ginger, come over. You want a sugar cane, you want jujubes or moringa, you come over.
Yeah.
We have it all here. So, mm-hmm. Maybe no one's talked about it, but we grow a lot of them.
Yeah, an incredibly diverse community and an incredibly diverse set of things that they grow. Okay, well, fabulous. Michael Yang, Molly Lee, and Shia Tao, thank you all so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you,
thank
having
you
us
so much,
here.
Carrie. And now, the weekend. A celebration of drag will take place Saturday night in Fresno at a benefit for the 30th annual Fresno Rainbow Pride Parade and Festival. I spoke with Fresno Rainbow Pride volunteer coordinator Tracy Cisneros about the event and the importance of ball culture to the LGBTQ+ community. So what can guests expect at the event on Saturday?
So at the event on Saturday, they can expect entertainment from some of the best gay, lesbian, and transgender, and queer performers in Fresno and the surrounding areas. What Saturday will be is an opportunity for us to bring some new talent to the area as well. Our performers are competing for titles for Mr., Ms., and Miss Fresno Gay Rainbow Pride 2020, which is also our 30th anniversary of Fresno Rainbow Pride. So it's going to be a huge event. We've got a grand total of 14 performances. It's a lot of performers, some of them performing in drag, some performing live singing, live dancing. It's going to be a great opportunity to see some special talent in the area. In addition to that, we've got Calavera Street Kitchen cooking some street food for us. We've got bacon-wrapped hot dogs and sliders. It's just going to be a good time for everybody.
For our listeners unfamiliar with ballroom culture, what is it?
So I want to say late 80s, early 90s in Harlem, the ballroom culture was an opportunity for the LGBTQ people of that area to get together and strut. In that culture, they created families or quote-unquote houses that would go and compete at the ballrooms in categories, predetermined categories. And it was just an opportunity to really show who they were, category being, you know, faith. And so they would strut their stuff, showing off their best looks in competition with each other and against other houses. Lots of things came out of that culture in the late 80s. You know, you saw like a big boom of voguing that comes out of that culture. We can thank the ballroom, Harlem ballroom culture for voguing in the late 80s. Madonna took a lot from that, a lot of inspiration from that whole movement in the late 80s, creating, you know, a lot of art from it as well. So that's kind of where it comes from as far as performance. But as far as community is concerned, there is, or was and is, an opportunity in this arena to meet like-minded individuals, to create families where, you know, a lot of our LGBTQ youth are kind of cast out and in search of the warmth of a family or friends, a community to call their own, kind of lost. And this gives them an opportunity to create family where there wasn't one, out of people who, you know, want to embrace them and kind of lift them up. So it serves a dual purpose. It's entertainment, but if you look past that, it's really all about community and family created from outcasts and friends.
So tell me a bit about the different categories that people will be competing in on Saturday.
So for Saturday, it's going to be handled much like a typical pageant, if anybody's ever been to any kind of pageant. We have an evening wear competition. They're going to show their best evening wear, gowns and suits, with a question and answer period of, you know, what they would do with their titles for the year, being that they would be crowned Mr., Ms., or Ms. Fresno Gay Rainbow Pride. What does that mean to them, and what do they intend to do with that title? So there is that evening wear category. The beginning, just kind of, they have an opening where we're introduced to each candidate. They're going to show us essentially the kind of performer they are in a strut from the entrance to the stage. What type of performer, what persona are they bringing to us today? and that is definitely their choice. They're going to bring us. It's going to be a surprise to me, to be honest, because they haven't shared exactly what they're doing with me, and I kind of like it that way. I like being surprised. So that first opening is kind of what they're bringing to the table. And then their last performance will be their talent. Like I said, some of them are trained professional dancers, singers. We have lip syncers doing drag. It's going to be a little, smorgasbord of talent that night, especially for their talent portion. So three performances from each candidate, their opening, their question and answer period in their evening wear, and then a show of exactly the talent they bring to the table that night. It's going to be great.
And are tickets still available?
Tickets are still available on our Facebook event page. At Fresno Gay Rainbow Pride, you'll find the event page for Ballroom 2020 and the link to Eventbrite on the website. People can also message me directly on Facebook. You can find my information on the event page as well. So any one of those places, we're all over the place. They can contact us there, or they can also go to FresnoRainbowPride.com and find all the information.
Great.
On our website.
Wonderful. Well, Tracy, thanks so much for sharing a bit about the event.
Thank you, and I'm happy to do so. Anytime I get a chance to talk about all the great stuff we're doing, I'm all for it. Fresno Rainbow Pride turns 30 this year. It's a big year for us, so we hope everybody comes out Saturday, June 6th for that as well in the Tower District.
Great. Well, thanks so much. We appreciate the time.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.